just ask out of curiosity, how many of you were here for a conversation last night next door? Oh, most of you. Okay, so there are a handful of you who weren't here for that conversation. That's totally fine. But as I mentioned, there are a lot of overlaps between what we were talking about yesterday and where I want to move our conversation for today. A very brief overview for the few of you who weren't here. The sort of central activity of last night was to make lists of what we consider sort of stereotypes or norms for gender categories. Oh yay, more people. I think there might be someone in search of more chairs too, so we might be all right. But there's space to be on the floor here too, since you're young people. Those of us with gimpy ankles and stuff might not like that as much. But we had just put on the list, on the board, some list of norms for men and norms for women. And I talked a little bit about the fact that we all live in a culture that, although we think a lot about different kinds of men and women, and we kind of believe in our, intellectually at least, that they're all different kinds of people in the world, and we tend to think that we like that. We do still live in a culture that gives us some pretty strong messages that there are certain ways to be a man that are good and ways to be a man that are less so, and that there are ways to be female in the culture that are the good ones or the appropriate ones or the normal ones, and then there are other ways of being female that are maybe going to be problematic or there are going to be some negative ideas about that. And as we talked, you know, we all realized in our conversation last night that, you know, that there are very few people who sort of fit one narrow sort of norm. The man who is strong and a breadwinner and doesn't show his emotions and doesn't cry and can carry anything and fix anything and, you know, be that guy. You know, men and women are all human beings, and we all have capacities for emotion, capacities for strength, capacities for intellectual rigor, and these things have been culturally and socially constructed in certain ways that are narrower than what our full human capacities for any of us might be. And so one of the things that I hope anyone coming to these sessions goes away with is just a reminder, if not a new idea, that if we are interested in not just acknowledging but celebrating the full range of human diversity, we want to be thoughtful about what we do with these ideologies that exist out in the world. Ideology is tricky because you end up wondering, who's responsible for that? Who made these ideas that men cannot cry? Whose idea? I don't know. It's out there, right? It's just out there, and parents sometimes reinforce it. Sometimes parents think to themselves, gosh, I don't want to reinforce that. You know, I want to raise a different kind of boy. But then there are these institutions that we go to, like public school, right, and playgrounds. And we go to churches, and we go to these sites in the culture. Well, we drive down streets, and there are billboards, right? We get magazines sent to our mailboxes. We see messages all over the place that often reinforce these norms of gender category. Welcome. I'm sorry that we don't have more chairs, but thanks so much for... if anyone wants to sit kind of up in here, too, you're welcome to sit on the floor. I don't have pillows to offer you of any kind. You could sit on a table here. I don't know. I'm going to end up putting a few things on the board. But at any rate, I think it's really important for all of us, in order to be consciously moving through the world in an ethical way, where we respect one another fully, where we are able to recognize the wide range of gifts that every individual has, we need to be wary of these messages and how we promulgate them, because they can be damaging, right? I don't know how many men in here feel like you grew up with a message that you shouldn't cry, and I don't know how you feel about whether that's been a struggle in certain situations or whether that has been hard. I know that I lost one of my cousins in a gun accident a number of years ago. It was sort of a horrible thing. He had a, his little boy was 7 years old at the time, and he was the one brother of a neighbor who agreed to help him move. And my other cousins, Johnny's brothers, didn't want to help this guy move because they didn't think he was a very nice guy. Johnny was the guy who helped anyone, you know, sunny personality, sure, I'll help. And this guy had a gun and was showing it off and didn't think it was loaded and pointed it right at John's face and pulled the trigger just in, like,
you
playing around.
Kid?
They were adults. My cousin had a child who was 7. I think John was, you know, 25 at the time, something like that. Yeah, blew his face off. And as you can imagine, I mean, you know, there are already just looks of, you know, pain on some of you. And Johnny had several brothers. I have this little passel of cousins. And at the funeral, one of those boys was very stoic, and one of those boys' brothers was very drunk, and one of those boys was just sobbing for the entire day, the entire service, everything. And there was a lot of whispering about the crying boy, you know, adult boy. And his own dad, my uncle, you know, is saying, uncle once removed, was saying, come on, pull yourself together. You know, you got to pull yourself together. And I remember, this was many years ago, and I just remember thinking, oh my goodness, what is the cost of grieving deeply for the loss of a loved one? Why, you know, what's at stake there to not cry in that situation? It's kind of remarkable when you pause to think about it. You know, what a natural thing to weep. And what an important physiological thing to weep. What an important psychological thing to weep for loss. And yet somehow we kind of have this weird situation where it's more okay for some people to cry when they are hurt or sad than other people. And I find that a little bizarre. And I do think there are a lot of studies that you can find that suggest that a lot of these messages are damaging and limiting to all of us. That we have these ideas that we ought to adhere really strictly to some.
It's more okay to get drunk and numb yourself. That's
right.
Curious, isn't it? Yeah. Because a guy will do that, right? A guy will drink. And somehow that's, you know, I don't know. If he had had a sister and the sister was raging drunk, I'm guessing there might have been a different judgment placed on that choice in that situation. So there are all kinds of moments in our lives where we can, you know, it's worth noticing who is doing what and how anyone is interacting with those people. And I think that we as people who want to be celebrating diversity, you know, our summer theme, celebrating the manifold gifts of God, the multicolored gifts of God, I think it's our duty or our calling, if we are people of the Word, the biblical Word, to be tuned into this a lot more than a lot of us seem to be. It's easy to kind of slide along with kind of the crowd or the way things go, you know, and just kind of pass on those messages or not intervene when you see other people trying to keep people in their gendered place, right? And I want us to think a lot, all hour, about just be thinking to yourselves, and I'll open this up for a much more of a back and forth in a little time from now. But be thinking already right now, why do we have an idea that men and women ought to be in these different kinds of personalities and attributes and skills and such? What is at stake? We know that we've sort of lived with this idea for a long time. Men and women are different in certain ways. Physiologically, biologically, chromosomally, there are differences. But a lot of the differences we construct ourselves. They are ideas, not realities. And if they are ideas, even if they're strong ones and frequently reinforced, then we have some agency to change our ideas and through our conversation make changes in these ideologies. Now, the difference between today's conversation and the text I want to share with you and yesterday's is that mainly we were talking about these ideas yesterday, these constructions, that these socially constructed concepts. And we agreed that they're all a little bit false. Most of us know men and women who are quite different than those norms, and they're wonderful people. But today I want to focus a little bit more on biology. There are ideas out there about men and women, but there's also a lot of people who are born with gender ambiguity in terms of sexual organs. Some people have, at birth, the organs of both sexes in their bodies. Some people have the chromosomes of both sexes, and yet their bodies present differently. So this mysterious sort of, the ways in which the human creature is created complexly, you know, we have all these different, you know, some giant million-letter-long genome or whatever. We are each unique in such remarkable ways. And we ought to remind ourselves, or become aware if we are not, that we aren't just men and women on the planet with the ideas associated with them. There's a lot of gray area. And medical science has grown by leaps and bounds in the 20th century and has been learning a lot more about what we often refer to as gender variance. I guess I have a bunch of terms I want to put on the board. But gender variance or gender, this is not a pleasing marker. That is not either. There we go. Gender ambiguity is sometimes a phrase used to refer to this. So, you know, we live in a world that loves science, and, you know, we often trust science, although not in some locations culturally. I don't know why that is. But it's another conversation, fortunately happening here in the village, in other rooms, even as we speak. A problem with medicalizing difference, bodily difference and physical difference, is often that we end up with some negativity associated with that, right? Anytime you have a norm and then something that is not normal, the field of medicine can really make that a problem to fix, right? The medical field is all about fixing somehow, and Western medicine is all about cutting and pasting in order to fix instead of maybe doing some other things. And it's true that in our somewhat recent past, in the 50s and 60s, a lot of experiments were done on children born with genitalia of both sexes, perceived by the medical community as problem, right? Oh my goodness, this is abnormal, what are we going to do? And so the medical field would just cut and paste. Well, let's cut some things off. Let's kind of make the body look like one gender and then just raise the kid as one gender because, boy, who knows what kind of damage there might be for a kid if they had both and were trying to negotiate, the playground?
Yeah.
Yeah, restrooms. Right. I mean, it's bad enough just having a name like we on the playground, let alone, you know, having some other realm of difference. I mean, don't try that at home. That's scarring. What these studies, you know, this is the 50s and 60s, right? These are real bodies, real kids, real people who are now in their 50s and 60s who have lived lives of having an experience of sometimes having doctors in their infancy make them look like a gender that's the opposite one of what they are inside. You know, imagine. Imagine if you as a child had had somebody else make a decision to cut and paste your sexual parts that identify you as one gender or not. And you're still the you are in your head right now, but somebody sort of stitch together the opposite body for you. You know, talk about damage. You know, we have to sort of think through what is more or less risky in terms of how we interact with people. Well, if we have this idea, this assumption that there's only men and only women, and then on top of that, we have a culture that really says that what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman looks like a really rigid thing, there's a lot of people out there, right? The pearls of great value that God is interested in. And that, you know, if you grew up in a family like mine, thinking in terms of a creative God who loves us all and makes us all the way we are, these people are being created in the ways that they are. And I think it's really important for us to try to take really seriously, what does it mean? We aren't going to tell by looking at them exactly how they feel aligned inside, right? This is tricky. You know, you don't just go up to people and meet them on the street and, you know, ask them, so are your body parts aligned with your sense of your gender or not? Like, how am I going to interact with you, you know? So if we don't know for sure whether someone's sense of self is aligned with their body, then we need to be careful. You know, we need to just sort of train ourselves, I think, to get a little bit outside of our usual assumptions and find ways to invite conversation with one another that don't sort of predicate themselves on those assumptions, right? And that's a big challenge. That feels uncomfortable, you know. I think that it's a really uncomfortable area at this point in history to know that we can encounter people who are men who were maybe not born as men, but they have lived out their lives experiencing themselves as men. Some of them might choose to have female parts, like surgery to take away female breasts so that their body feels more in line with who they are. And that's a story that is not everyone's story, but one that is an important story. And these people's lives and their experiences and how they've been treated and how they view the world can offer us a lot of rich knowledge and value that we should want to gain access to if we want to grow and be really rich people ourselves and really have a good capacity to celebrate the great diversity of the natural world. So, you know, I don't have like a little list of like the top 10 rules to bear in mind when you move through the world trying to be alert or sensitive to gender ambiguity or gender diversity, but something to be aware of. There are more and more sort of blogs online, people writing about their experiences. There are some resources for people in the health professions about how to interact with people with the gender variants of all kinds. And as with any category of difference, last week we were talking about skin color difference and physical disabilities. And what else were we talking about last week? Class privilege or class difference. And we do live in a world where there are a lot of people who we know their lives are different than ours. And we know that sometimes when we're in a position of privilege and others are in positions where there's less social privilege, it's awkward to figure out how to connect. You know, you don't necessarily want to be patronizing, but what it is to offer help can sometimes come across in a not very respectful way. But I think the call is to risk connecting and getting closer to people and asking for people to share their stories with you. And somehow moving through the world in a way that what you say and how you talk about your own experiences will convey to others that you are a safe place to share a different kind of story. That's the real challenge, I think. Because otherwise, you know, people who are different in some way might not know, can I share my full self with you? Well, if you go around saying, you know, I hope it's not my son wearing the birthday tiara because boys don't do that, you know, you might not get to know someone well because they aren't going to choose to share with you their complicated story because you have a weird idea about what boys should play with on the playground. I was at a birthday party with a friend of mine who's turned 70, and she had children there and a bunch of grandchildren. And the grandkids, boys and girls, were all running around taking turns with the little paper birthday tiara, right? That grandma had been given as this princess goofy cardboard thing, you know. So they're like playing tag or something like that. They're trying to keep the tiara away. And one of those sons, one of the fathers of these children, was in a complete huff. He was just, my son better not be playing that game wearing that tiara. Now, what is that about? What is the fear driving someone to think a cardboard tiara touching the head of my son for 10 minutes is a problem that I'm going to be angry about at my own mother's birthday party? Yeah. Right? We chuckle, but there's got to be something real behind that. There's got to be something that we need to understand somehow and respond to, not just with chuckles, but with some kind of way of articulate and graceful intervention, some kind of loving intervention. I did not have a good idea. I was enough of an at that party, I was enough of an outsider to the family system that I didn't feel it was a good moment for me to go up to this dude and be like, dude, cardboard tiara, you know? Is it going to magically turn your boy into a girl? You know? Is he going to, you know, somehow start crying tomorrow because he wore a tiara today and you don't want that boy to turn into something? I don't know. Very
but
curious.
It would reflect on him.
What kind of a man would I be to let my boy have a tiara on his head? What kind of man would you be? Real question. In their left mind,
I may believe it will make a difficult life for his son.
Ah, so you sense some compassion embedded in that fear.
Right.
Interesting and plausible, right? And yet, maybe for the child, hard to sense the compassion or recognize it when you're just being yelled at, right? Interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, my experience in my own family with two boys and then my father's reaction and my brother's reactions to certain things that they do, a lot of it seems to be around fear of the suffering my boys will go through if they keep acting that way at school.
Mm.
Of what they're going to get from their peers. And so I've got to, you know, my dad's attitude is, you got to intervene now so they aren't going to suffer later. And it's this kind of view of, this very fear-based view of the world of what they're going to suffer. But I wanted to say that I see a lot of fear in the other direction, too, among not just my female friends, but particularly among my female friends, of any kind of play that suggests violence.
Mm-hmm.
That there's also a, there's, at least as a mom of boys, I'm really sensitive to the judgment that they get from both ends of the spectrum of both this, you better not be girly because of this, because of whatever. But you better not be violent. You better not be rough in your play. You better not do anything that suggests weapons. That's a big, 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 you know.
Uh-huh.
You
for
better
boys
not,
or for girls
so
here?
Pardon?
For boys or for girls here? Any of them?
For anyone. But I get a lot of that even with my boys.
Uh-huh.
In school systems and preschool and whatever, that there's a lot of judgment on kids' play, whatever it is, because we take it so seriously.
Yeah.
Like it's going to be,
it's
going to define who they are as they grow older, instead of, my gosh, they're just playing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just let them
play.
Yeah.
And play can do a lot of things. You know, it can give one room to try on senses of selves in order to figure out where do I feel comfortable.
Right.
And who would not want their child to find where they feel comfortable? A lot of people, it turns out.
Yeah.
A lot of people would rather stick them over in this category and say, you will be comfortable here or I'll be damned.
I think regardless of where the fear is coming from, there's just a lot of adult fear around the behaviors and play and activities of children maybe because we take it way too seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think it's really worth, you know, again, not to be answerable in 35 minutes, but really to explore the nature of that fear. It's one thing to name it as fear that is causing us to want boys and girls to act in certain kinds of ways, but it's a really big thing, right? I mean, there are dead children every day because of the damage caused from loving family members who try to get them to be something they are not. So there's a damage there that's possible, as well as damage on the playground. You know, you can tell a kid not to wear a tiara as much as you want, but if that kid is more at home in a tiara than a cowboy hat, the kid's gonna, that's not gonna go away necessarily because you think it should. And so then you're sort of multiplying potential damage instead of assuaging it. I saw this hand up first. Yes, please.
What if it's not fear that he will be gay? Maybe it's fear of, maybe he's had no experience dealing with someone who is gay, so he has no idea how he would connect with his son after that.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
I'm going to fear of lacking tools to connect. I know how to interact with a boy is boy, but I don't know how I would interact or how I would talk to or what to do with that, right? That's just, we are all fearful of those places where we're ignorant, right? Nobody likes to feel like an idiot. That's terrible. But if we lack knowledge, what is our responsibility to ourselves and what is our responsibility to people around us? To fall into that fear, I'm an idiot, I don't know how to talk to you, so you should go do something different, right? That's something to take seriously. Yes, please.
Well, kind of like from a view of somebody who is like not really like, it's like not a parent, but more of a peer kind of thing. Like it kind of falls under the judgment and lacking tools of connection. Like since I'm going into high school and it's kind of when kids are exploring, you know, trying to find out like what they are. I've actually had an experience like where a girl has had a crush on me and I didn't really know how to interact around her, people judged her, and I think it's almost kind of like in that kind of age area, it's more of a fear of them liking you, and then you don't know what to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, it's only an hour, it's an absurd amount of time to talk about a lot of this. But I do want to borrow from that conversation and sort of tie together these ideas that somehow gender variance has a relationship to sexual orientation, because we know there's a lot of fear and concerns about the sexual orientation variance in the world as well. And that's going to be a topic for tomorrow. But I do want to point out that it's useful to all of us to kind of separate out what these words sort of technically refer to. Sex is usually a word, I mean, we all use them in kind of muddy ways. People use them a little bit differently. But I think it's helpful if we think of sex in terms of biology and body, right? Male, female, and the rest of us, right? The XXYs, the XYs that present as female, the XXs that present as male. You can go online and there's a long list of sort of medical names for a lot of hormonal variants, etc., for people who are just going to be somewhere in between, right? Gender, as we were talking about these gender categories on the board yesterday, male, female, is, I think, better used to talk about the cultural constructions instead of the bodies, right? Masculinity and femininity rather than male and female, right? Because one can be male and not have fully masculine attributes. One can, you know, we talk about feminine men sometimes, usually pejoratively. Why is that? Because men should be real men and women are sort of negative relative to men in the culture. Anyway, vice versa. There is female masculinity. I wear my hair short. I shop in the boys' shoe department, you know, I don't know. I get a lot of feedback that I'm sort of not the feminine style of person that people kind of think that I'm going to be. And, you know, it's not a big loss to me that people in a store are going to frown at me because they're like, don't you want the girls section, you know? But still, that's awkward, you know? It's like, well, you sell shoes. Can I just buy some shoes that I like? Do you, stranger to me, have to stand there with your furrowed brow because I'm walking there instead of over there? Like, what is that about? But gender is something that in scholarly circles and in scholarly discourse, we talk about gender performance, right? You can be a man who behaves in a very masculine or macho fashion, but that's a type of attributes, ways of carrying yourself, ways of dressing, etc. And that doesn't have a direct, always one-to-one relationship with the body underneath. Does that make sense? So the affect or the performance of what these categories are does not always just fall right into comfortable line with the bodily male and female. Now, sexual orientation is a whole other thing. Whether or not one is attracted to a person of the same sex or a different sex may or may not line up with male or female, and it may or may not line up with a gender identity. That is kind of a complication that all of them are kind of these variances, these differences. Uh-oh, boys who don't seem like boys. And then there's this slippage, like, oh no, is the fact that you wore a pink t-shirt going to mean that you're attracted to a man 10 years from now? You know, may or may not. But do we need to fear either of those outcomes? Should we have concerns about colors associated with children? It's a curious thing. There are a lot of studies that have been done that suggest that one of the reasons for negative attitudes toward men and women or boys and girls who do not fully ascribe to a norm of gender is because we do still live in a culture where there are power differentials, where it is still true that men are in a more privileged position than women. And so there's often some concern on the part of anyone who can't tell where someone fits, because without even thinking about it, we are often sort of groomed to value people in a certain way who are men that is different than how we value people who are women. And so it can be uncomfortable. There's a study done, I don't know, a decade or more ago about just movement on streets, you know, and it seems as though men get to walk right down the sidewalk and not move out of the way for women. And women are supposed to move out of the way for men, apparently. These rules are not written anywhere. They are played out, right? So you can study human behavior and notice that. But if someone is walking down a street who is perhaps ambiguous in their gender identification, sometimes people just glance at my hair and they call me sir and stuff. And it's like, women have short hair too. But I'm a person who has had people sort of, you know, have to do a double take, you know, like, wait, who am I interacting with or something? And if you think about the study about an assumption that men get the right of way on a sidewalk and women don't, you can see how a man might have a moment of, I don't know, do I move out of the way? Like, I need to know whether I'm in a moment where I get my right of way because I assume that in the company of a woman walking the other direction, but now I don't know, you know? Not knowing what to do is an uncomfortable place to be. But somehow feeling uncomfortable often leads to agitation or anger or confrontation, and then we see damage happening, right? I'm lucky enough to have never experienced physical violence for wearing short hair and shopping in the men's shoes department. But again, there are dead children in the world for those same social errors, right? Those same social sins. I live about 20 miles away from Oxnard, California, where there's been a very current news, a big trial, because Oxnard is where there was a 14-year-old boy who was effeminate, who wore more feminine clothes to school, seemed to behave in a more emotional, more sort of feminized kind of way. And it turned out that by 14, he knew that he was a gay man and had identified himself that way. Well, he liked a boy in his class, made the error at 14 of having a crush on someone. You know, I don't know about you, but crushes are supposed to be kind of fun and terrifying things to experience, you know, whether they pan out or not. You can't decide to have a crush by the nature of crushes, right? We've all had them, you know. But he liked a boy who was in his class, and the boy found out. And a day after he found out, he brought a gun to school, sat behind him in their computer class for half of the hour, and then just pulled the gun out of his bag and shot the kid in the back of the head. Killed him in the middle of the classroom. So now that boy is on trial. And his defense is that it was a certain kind of self-defense because of the boy's attraction, and that made him uncomfortable. So he had to act in the spur of the moment. I don't know how the next day bringing your gun to school is the spur of the moment response. But there are really serious implications to this discussion, in other words. And it's not just about, you know, whether or not women get paid the same amount as men for the same work. These are other kinds of problems. But we're talking about attitudes and behaviors that damage the psyche, the mental health, the spiritual sense of self, the bodies, and the lives of a lot of people. And if we're not careful, if we do not present ourselves to the world as people who value difference, and we need to make that explicit, because if you don't make it explicit, people who are vulnerable aren't going to know. People in this culture are still going to have a fallback position of fear and worry if they don't have a material clue from us about whether we are safe because of those guns in the backpacks of who knows who, right? So that is a certain kind of responsibility that I think we have. Yes, please.
I'd like to go back to the fear of the parent.
Uh-huh.
If my kid acts up in school, people think, how is he being raised at home?
Mm-hmm.
That causes that.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about sexual orientation, we say genetic and environmental influences. So we're saying there's something that may be happening in the home that causes certain kind of reactions. So the parent is struggling with, you know, I'm responsible for the behavior of my child. How am I responsible for the sexual orientation?
Yeah. Well, I would say to that that many, many studies and most personal stories, memoirs, anecdotes of people who are of a non-heterosexual orientation, the data is out there that it is not an environmentally influenced thing. The data suggests that by the age of 3, one, and possibly in the womb, it's considered a chemical, it's part of development, it seems to be a 10% variance, no matter what region you're in, no matter what kind of family you're in, like left-handedness, you know, there are about 10% of kids end up left-handed, and they have their own special little war to survive, right? You know, until you figure out that they're right-handed, they can't do stuff that they're being asked to do. There is an idea out there that parents can cause a child to be gay or lesbian or bisexual, but there is not data to support that that is a correct idea. So I think that does, I certainly understand that that's a living fear for a lot of people. I'm going to mess up. I'm going to make gay kids somehow because I'm not emotional enough, or I'm too emotional, or I'm too stern, or I'm not stern enough, right?
Well, also in teenage, it is not unusual for children to have a homosexual or heterosexual experience.
Mm-hmm.
I counseled with a young fellow who had a homosexual experience, and he came with great fear and anxiety.
Yeah.
He says, does that mean I am a homosexual? I said, no, you had a homosexual experience.
Yeah.
You may you may be bisexual, you may have different levels. Don't, you know, when we use the you are, we lock people into an identity that I think is very destructive.
I think you're exactly right about that. I agree with that 100%. Who was here for last Sunday's sermon by the New York bishop who talked about the wheat and the chaff? A few of you? Should I take the time to mention this? Yeah. The sermon was about the parable in the Bible where the landowner has sown some wheat seeds. And then in the night, someone has come and sown weeds in the same area. And so then the people working the field, they realize as these seeds start to sprout, they recognize that some of them are wheat sprouts and some of them are these dangerous, poisonous weed sprouts. And you probably remember this story, some echo. The field workers come to the landowner and say, what should we do? Should we weed out the unhealthy plants? And the landowner says, no, let them all grow together. And when they have come to fruition, I will go into the field and I will gather up all of the healthy wheat and we'll put it in the barn and we'll make our bread from it. And at that time, we will gather up all of the fully grown chaff and we'll burn it because we don't need it. It doesn't make bread, right? But he says, the landowner says, no, don't weed now. And there are a lot of reasons for that. If you weed now, you pull up the roots of all of the healthy little plants, right? Any of you who have gardened know that weeding is a delicate process, right? And if you're looking at little baby plants, sometimes it's hard to tell yet which is the chaff and which is the weed. So far, they're both a single 2-inch green stalk. Right? Like, you're going to go out with your little genetic tester and, like, you know, take a little blood sample of every little stalk and make sure you're getting the wrong ones out from the right ones. Well, this is a parable of God, right? And the bishop's sermon was basically saying, if God is the landowner and says, do not go around weeding the garden yourselves, you gardeners, you aren't going to do it well enough. You don't know quite enough about what you're doing. Let everything grow together, and I will judge when it's time to judge. And so the reminder of last week's sermon for people who were in the village was a reminder that we're not the ones who are supposed to say, you get to belong here and you don't, right? Because we might think that we're right about that, but we might not be. And we might be hurting ourselves in the meantime. So the message there from the biblical, you know, if God is the landholder, we're reminded, just focus on growing yourself to be good wheat. Be the best darn wheat stalk that you can be, and don't mess with what other people are doing. Don't go around saying, you're chaff, you're chaff, you're chaff, burn, right? So I think of this because of just the statement, you know, he said, for someone to say, you are this or that is a problem. To allow someone the room to say, I am, is a very different thing, right?
Or I feel.
I am, I sense myself to be this way, right? Here are my experiences. I am the best interpreter of my experiences, right? And you might think, well, yeah, activity does not equal an identity in and of itself, right? Kinsey in the 50s came out with this report suggesting that there's a very traditionally organic bell curve associated with sexual experience, and that there are certain people who only have exclusively same-sex attractions and relations with one another. There is a small set of people who has exclusively only ever heterosexual attractions and feelings. And there are a whole bunch of people in here. What does that mean for us? You know, again, when we're talking about sexuality, that is a separate thing from gender variance. Gender, the bodily differences that people have, may or may not correlate with what their gender is going to be. There are a lot of people who are damaged, say, on the playground or by their family members, who are heterosexual men who are sensitive. You know? I mean, just not fitting that category can cause someone to get into trouble socially, right, with the social fabric. And so that is sometimes when you're perceived to have a homosexual orientation or a non-heterosexual orientation, you get into the same trouble or you get up beat up by the same kids, whether or not you are. It's a perception kind of thing. So we need to care about those people too, right? You don't have to go around saying, wait a minute, are you a card-carrying queer? Because then I will love you, and I will support you, and I will cherish you as a pearl of God. And if you're not, if you're seeming gay and yet you are heterosexual, then we might still be in some trouble, right? So all of these things kind of play together in this really weird net, this intersecting net. And I'm keeping an eye on the clock. I want to share with you toward the end of our time portions of the story of Baby X that I mentioned on the board. I want to point you to these stories that are interesting ones and provocative. It would take me the whole hour to just sit and read a story to you, so I didn't plan to read the whole thing, but I want to read a few portions and then tell you about it. It's all over the internet. The story of Baby X was written by one of the people who was responsible, if you remember the early 70s book and album, Free to Be You and Me. How many of you know that book and album? Ah, a ton of you, right? And even some younger generations. Awesome. Did your parents pull it out? And yeah. And you're like, oh God, Mom and Dad. Like, it's kind of cheesy now. I don't know. It has a cheese factor that, you know, it just does. But it's also lovely and interesting, right? And so you get these boys who have dolls and parents who are like, don't mess with my kid because he has a doll, right? And there are all these messages, you know. The story of Baby X was written in 1972 by one of the Free to Be You and Me minds, and it was published in 1982 in a collection of books called Stories for Free Children. And I don't know if that's still in print or not, but it is out there, and this story is there. But it's also used in colleges, curricula, so you can find a copy of it on the net. And the story of Baby X is about a kid who the parents will not tell anyone whether their child is male or female. And there are all kinds of implications of that, right? So I do want to talk about that in a moment. There was a hand up here I didn't want to overlook.
Oh, that's fine. I was just saying that, just to go back to the gender element, this is the gay straight binary is a really helpful model that maybe we talk about a lot more than the gender binary for us to see that, you know, if it's one or the other, then it's that it can become destructive. So
yeah. I'm going to put another term up here that is probably familiar to some of you, maybe not a lot of you. Because there are a lot of chromosomal reasons why people might end up not tidily in a male or female box, the term intersex has been used of late, maybe in the last two or three decades, to refer to people who are somewhere in between, somewhere on a curve of some sort. I think this curve might go the other way around a little bit, that more people are female, more people are male, and it might be a low number instead of a high number of people in the middle. But nevertheless, there is a curve and a bunch of people in the middle there.
So is our Christian concept of sexual purity contrary to the nature of human beings, where the person might be 30% heterosexual and 70% homosexual, or the other way around?
That is an excellent way of putting it. Yeah. I think it's difficult to numerically situate someone 70-30 in that way. I totally get what you're saying. The curve implies that, you know, if someone were over here, someone that we might call what's in between here bisexual, and someone might have a strong tendency to mainly be attracted to the opposite sex, but might have situations where there is a very comfortable and healthy attraction and interaction with a member of the same sex. But, you know, over the course of a lifetime, if you look at the frequency or something, those numbers might vary. I think it'd be difficult to pin down, 30% of the time I do this or that. But I do think it's fair to say that what we know now about the natural world and its incredible diversity and how it works, how plants work, how animals work. There are same-sex relations and behaviors in over 1,000 species of animals that science studies. And somehow this is nerve-wracking to people who don't want people to have that experience. But, you know, we have ways of understanding our insides, you know, down to the gene and the atom and all of these things, that there simply wasn't any way to understand or conceptualize at the time that the Bible was being written. So people who were living in biblical times had an outside eye view of the body, but didn't necessarily have a number of ways of understanding how things work. So that's, I mean, I'm not a biblical scholar, but that's my it's a pretty basic answer, but I think it does help explain some things. You know, we have technology to understand all kinds of stuff that just wasn't known in the past. What am I missing? I think one last thing that I'd like to say about gender variance is that gender variance has been known historically around the globe. In all kinds of cultures, in times and places, there have been different names in different languages for people who are what we might think of now as intersex or a third sex. And there are long lists of cultures and the names they have for these people. It's not a modern sin. It's not a newfangled idea to kind of start muddying these simple categories exactly, right? So there are Native American cultures that had two spirits and Berdake, who were people who were understood to have the spirits of both genders within them. And they weren't necessarily concerned with what a body looked like or not, or what the chromosomes were. There was just an acknowledgement that you seem to have an embodied sense of all the attributes that we might associate on either side of a gender spectrum. And that was considered for Native Americans a great gift. You were a gifted person called for a special role in the society if you had that unique gift. Because it meant things for how you could communicate with all kinds of people, how you could empathize with a wider range of people, how you had a vision of things that was from the margins and able to see through certain kinds of assumptions, right? You've probably all heard of the terms androgynous, right, or androgyne, or you've heard of the term hermaphrodite. These are older terms. They both have Greek stems, and andro is the Greek word for male, and gyne is the word for female, and Hermes was a Greek male god, the messenger god. And Aphrodite, right, is the Greek goddess of love. And so these were terms that were used from classical times to describe people who seemed to be somewhere in the middle, who seemed to have aspects or qualities of each gender category. And again, for the Greeks, there was not a pejorative sense of this. There was not a pejorative sense for people who had same-sex attractions or people whose bodies or gender attributes seemed to be in the middle or different than the main categories. And we forget that at a cost. You know, we live in a culture where there are a lot of people who will say that people have been made men and women and heterosexual for millennia. God made men and women in a certain kind of way, and that's always been true. And here we have this modern world with all its nefarious, you know, insidious marketing and advertising and sinfulness and all these things. And now we have these bad people running around blurring these lines that we're so comfortable with, right? Well, that's just a sheer falsehood. You study anthropology, you study history, you study other cultures, you get less of a myopic view of the global human history, and you realize that that's just not true. And then you again are reminded of the fact that we have a choice to make about how we value or disvalue the variance among us. It's not a given that every culture, that it is human nature to diss the people who don't fit into a category. That is not fundamentally human. It tends to be true for the last several centuries from the European continents and those who have ended up over here, but wasn't necessarily true of all kinds of cultures. So that should matter to us as alert and intellectual people of a certain sort. So little time for this for poor baby X. Yes, please.
Baby X.
Are you sure?
Baby X.
Yeah, we can have more conversation. And you know, again, tomorrow's session will overlap with all of these things. I'll just give you sort of the setup and then characterize how this story goes. There's a sense of humor here. Once upon a time, a baby named X was born. This baby was named X so that nobody could tell whether it was a boy or a girl. Its parents could tell, of course. I don't know if it's of course, given what I have said right now, right? This was 1972. But they couldn't tell anybody else. They couldn't even tell baby X at first. It was all part of a very important secret scientific experiment, spelled with an X, an experiment, officially known as Project Baby X. The smartest scientists had set up this experiment at a cost of exactly $23 billion and 72 cents. Which might seem like a lot for just one baby, even a very important experimental baby. But when you remember the prices of things like strained carrots and stuffed bunnies and popcorn for the movies and booster shots for camp, let alone 28 shiny quarters from the Tooth Fairy, or 28 shiny $20 bills, or whatever the Tooth Fairy rate is these days, I don't know. You see how the money adds up. These scientists had worked out the details of an experiment and had written an official instruction manual for baby X's parents about how to interact with this child in a non-gendered fashion, right? So the parents have this guide where it's the female parent who tosses a baseball with the kid, it's the male parent who cooks meals for him and sings him to sleep, and they just do everything they can to sort of counter this strict gender role sort of way of behaving, right? It took a long time for the scientists to figure out what couple was going to be able to do this, you know? And they had a big test, right? And a ton of people failed the test, you know? They wanted to name their baby after their grandfather, you know? So they weren't willing to name it Baby X. They had investments in sort of creating these gender affiliations. But the Joneses bring their baby home, and they're all fine, and the neighbors are not fine. And what ends up happening in the story is that the neighbors, again, they all need to know whether it's a boy or a girl because they somehow have a need to interact with it in a certain way. And this is interesting. There have been a lot of studies shown about how we interact with children, too. And it is phenomenal how if we know that a baby is a boy, that kid is much more likely to be thrown up in the air, swung around, dumped on the ground, right? Boys are rough and tumble and all that. And we interact with kids from the moment they're an infant like that. And girl babies are held facing the parent more often, and boy babies are strapped on to be facing the world out here. Female babies are not tossed in the air as often or tossed on the ground or laughed at in a rough and tumble kind of way. And so, and you know how it is to buy baby clothes, right? It's blue or pink. Yeah, only blue or pink. It's really hard to get gender-neutral toys for children, to get gender-neutral clothes. Again, you go into a store and you try to buy a pink shirt for your boy that's in the stroller or whatever, you're going to have the same experience as me with the shoes, right? What are you going to do to that boy to put a piece of fabric on his skin that has been dyed in that fashion? It's going to dye right through the into the skin or something. I don't know what it's going to do. But so this experiment is to try to treat this child as much both as possible, and to try to break down those stereotypes. Well, the neighbors get mad. They're like, well, if I don't know how to interact with your kid, I'll be darned. You know, and they end up closing their shutters. They don't want to see the parents. It's this really pervasive awkwardness, right? They don't know what gifts to buy the child for its birthday. So they just don't buy any gifts at all. And they don't bring their own kids to the birthday party. Because they're like, whoa, right? It's this awkwardness, this fear of lack of understanding. You know, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to pull back instead of go into the situation. The baby seems fine. The baby goes, you know, grows up, and X is like 5 years old on the playground, and X does whatever X wants. X plays with the trucks, X plays with the dolls, X talks to all the little kids and gets everyone to play games together. You know, we have much more playing together of kids here at Holden Village than we do often in public schools. You know, kids get trooped onto the playground in groups of girls or groups of boys, and the boys don't want to touch the girls, and the girls all want to keep away from the icky boys, and you know, there's a lot of messaging out there that we shouldn't interact. Baby X in the story ends up bringing children together and driving adults apart. And then the scientists come in at a later date, and they think there's going to be a psychological problem. And they end up discovering that the kid is the only one who's fine in the whole situation. And like everyone else, the adults have gotten psychologically screwed up. They're angry and bitter and uncomfortable. I think maybe not the parents. Didn't read quite through the end again. But it's a really thought-provoking piece. And it was written with this idea of just the, oh, of course it's a male or a female and we're just not going to tell. But with newer knowledge that there are actual kids who are both, more than neither. You know, to be neither gender is a misnomer, probably. But to be both is a position that exists out there. And if we can find it in ourselves to value that possibility and to think about what we might gain from that unique perspective on what it is to be human and how we can interact, I think it will enrich us all rather than causing damage to us all.